A mayor who had COVID-19 returns to work and preparing for hurricane season during a pandemic. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Miami Mayor Francis Suarez contracted the virus back in March. He had to go into self-quarantine for a few weeks. We're talking with the mayor today about his experience, the city's response to the virus, and how to return to normalcy. Also, we're about to enter hurricane season, and we don't know if we'll still be living in a world of social distancing. Are local governments, as well as the state and federal government, ready to deal with a hurricane and a pandemic? Finally,
you can actually create a parallel universe where you are free of your problems for 4 minutes or 5 minutes that a song lasts.
How are musicians earning a paycheck in a time when we can't have concerts? Sundial producer Chris Remington went out to see for himself. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, it was last month when Mayor Francis Suarez learned that he had the COVID-19 virus. He had to self-quarantine, and during that time, he shared his daily experiences with people through social media. Now, he's fine now and slowly returning to running the city in the midst of a pandemic. Mayor Suarez, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. And by the way, if you have a question for the mayor, please give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. You can always tweet us or Facebook us your question at WLRN Sundial. Well, first of all, Mayor, how are you feeling? How was the recovery?
I feel well. It's been good. I didn't get a very, very severe case of the virus. I had essentially no fever and no sore throat. So I had what amounts to a cold. I had congestion. I had some body aches at the beginning. I had a little bit of mild fever. I got up to about 99, never got past 99, never got to 100. So it was relatively mild. But I will say that it definitely, for me, it made me understand what an asymptomatic person could do if they went unchecked.
You know, you are in a unique position. I mean, as a mayor of a major city, you had the virus and you recovered and you had to stay isolated for, I believe it was more than 3 weeks, right?
It was 18 days to be exact.
Yeah. Well, so what?
Close to 3 weeks.
That experience, I mean, how is it shaping the way you're now approaching doing your job? And again, in a city that, in an area that is hardest hit in the state.
You know, we took very proactive steps in the city, our manager, our commissioners, prior to me getting sick. We had canceled Ultra and we had canceled Cayocho, both festivals that had a combined attendance of about 400,000 people. In the case of Ultra, it's from 105 different countries. And we were criticized by some locally about that decision. Some said, you know, that we were open, we should be saying that we're open for business and it's the wrong message. You know, obviously our beaches didn't get closed, which I think created problems, a tremendous amount of problems in festivals that happened over there. So, you know, we took very proactive steps before, you know, I got sick. Once I got sick, I think it highlighted, you know, the fact that there are many asymptomatic carriers of the virus that are going undetected right now. And that's a concern in terms of a flare up of the virus. And I think the second part is, you know, I was, because I'm the mayor, I had to go through a very strict testing protocol from the CDC. But I'm concerned that, you know, as you mentioned, Louis, you know, about 8,000 people or more in Dade County have tested positive. How are those people now going to have confidence that they can go back to work safely unless we have some sort of a testing protocol for them? So those are the things that I think, being someone that was COVID positive, first, I was able to blog and journal and give people a sense of calm that, you know, it's not a death sentence. Obviously, for me, I was blessed to be in that category of people that are asymptomatic. But for others, obviously, they've gotten much more severe symptoms. And it varies very much person to person.
Again, we're talking with Miami Mayor Francis Suarez. If you have a question, call in 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. You can always find us on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Mayor, something interesting you just said. You had to go through this extensive process of retesting to make sure that you were clear. What was that like? How many tests?
I was sort of a guinea pig because, if you remember, I was the second person in all of Miami-Dade County that tested positive. Now we obviously have over 8,000 cases, but I was literally almost patient zero. So I took experimental tests. Our department tested certain, those fast-acting tests on me. I probably took in total about 7 tests. I took 5 of the nasal tests, and I took 2 of the blood-drawn tests to test to see if they were accurate. In fact, we ended up not buying a lot of those blood-drawn tests. We were going to buy 100,000, and we decided not to because we didn't feel that they were accurate, at least the ones that we tried on me. And so, I was sort of a guinea pig, and the strict CDC testing protocol required me to test negative twice in a 24-hour period. And I got retested, I think, at day 11. I tested positive again. And I got retested again, I think, on day 14, and it was inconclusive. So I didn't actually test negative for the first time until day 17.
And so, because you bring up the issue of testing, what are you doing right now to expand the access to testing throughout the city, throughout the area?
Well, we're the city that's testing the most number of people. We're the first city that began testing people at home. We began testing the elderly. Now we test people of all ages at home. It's been incredibly successful. We may be the only city that's doing in-home testing. I know Miami-Dade County just started doing it a couple of days ago, but we were the first ones doing that. So we're testing about 500 people a day. I think if you're symptomatic, there's a 99% chance that you're going to get tested for free within a day or 2 days at the most. So I'm not so concerned about people that are symptomatic. What I'm more concerned about is people that are asymptomatic carriers. And the only way to test at scale would be if there was an antibody test that we felt confident in. And we still have not been able to identify an antibody test that we feel confident in that we can get in bulk to test people who may be asymptomatic. The second part is testing people with antibody tests who have already tested positive. And we're working on trying to find ways to test people who have already tested positive so that they can have a negative test and feel confident going back to work. And also potentially donating plasma like I did.
And I want to ask about that, too, in a moment here. But, you said that Miami's the city testing the most. Is that in the state or nationally? What are you talking about?
I think that's probably in the state.
Okay.
I don't think that we're testing the most nationally as a city.
Was it per capita? Or the state?
No, the state.
Okay.
I would say the state. Certainly in Dade County, most likely in the state as well. I think, there's certain cities like New York that I'm sure are testing at a much, much greater level than we are.
Right. So, no. Yeah, no. And I don't have the exact numbers. That's why my mistake. I meant per capita. I wanted to move over to this other issue. Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez is meeting today to discuss how to start reopening stuff from parks to beaches, businesses. And we're waiting to see what that is. But what are your thoughts about when we should start having those discussions? Are you already having those discussions?
Well, look, we are. There's two pieces to it, right? There's obviously discussions that you have internally with your medical experts. And I think part of the concern that we have with our medical experts in terms of analyzing the data, and you look at 3 data points. You look at new cases, you look at hospitalizations, and you look at deaths. Understanding that deaths lag usually between 10 days to 21 days past an infection. And so what we're seeing is that Miami hit a high point of new infections on March 31st, based on the data that we have. Dade County, that implemented some of the measures after we did, hit a high point on April 3rd, and so did the state of Florida. So that's of new cases. In terms of hospitalization, we've been analyzing the data that has been provided to us. And I would say over the last 5 to 6 days, the discharge rate is double the amount of the intake rate, which is also a very, very good sign. That means that twice as many people are being discharged from hospitals as being cured from COVID-19 as are actually coming in. And that also affects, obviously, census data. And the third thing we look at is deaths. And as I said, there's usually a delay in that reporting, which is why you're seeing the death toll continue to rise and rise at a record level, even though the new incidence level is going down. So I think you know, the conversation of opening up and shutting down, it really needs to be done very carefully in consultation with the medical experts. We've been consulting with Dr. Marty at FIU. We've been consulting with the CDC, which is what's helped us promulgate a lot of the orders that we put into place.
But are you also talking with other municipalities, but also the county, you know, to make sure that everybody's on the same page?
You know, we do, our emergency managers do talk to the county. We're not always on the same page. Sometimes we disagree on things philosophically, like we disagreed on closing, you know, obviously canceling Ultra and canceling Calle Ocho, and then the county later, a few days later, ended up canceling the Miami Open and canceling the youth fair. You know, we were the second city to put in a stay-at-home order, and the mayor, until he consulted with the League of Cities, decided then to put in a stay-at-home order. No curfew. We put in a curfew. They didn't want to put in a curfew. And so there's been, unfortunately, disagreements throughout this process and maybe philosophical differences. For us, our overriding emphasis is going to be health and safety. That's going to be number one. Because if you don't prioritize health and safety in terms of your decision making, then whatever slight boost to the economy that you have by opening up is going to be counteracted by the fact that you're going to have to close right back up again if we have a flare-up or a second wave of COVID-19. So for us, what we've demonstrated with the numbers that I've shared with you is that the social distancing, the stay-at-home orders, the curfew, it's all working.
Yeah. So the other thing, too, is the peak date that we're expecting has been pushed back into May again. So that's still something to think about. I want to go to the phones, and I'm going to go to Peter in Miami. Talking a little bit about testing. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you. A lot of compliments and one suggestion. First, compliments to WLRN and Lewis. You guys are doing a fantastic job. You're it kind of reminds me of Brian Norcross back in the day with Hurricane Andrew.
Well,
so compliments to you guys.
Well, thank you.
And Mayor Suarez, glad to hear you're feeling better. And I want to compliment you about being proactive and taking steps. I try to get a test with the state. It was a little bit of a complication, so then I went to step two, which was calling and trying to make an appointment at Marlins Park. Unfortunately, you have to call at 9 o'clock in order to go the following day, and every time I call at 9:01, it was already all jammed up and I was able to get in there. But fortunately, you have an alternative in Hadley Park, so I was able to go in on Saturday. The fire department or whoever's out there is absolutely fantastic. They did the test.
Thank you.
Two questions for you. Question number one, when can I expect my results? I did it Saturday about 9:30 in the morning. And then question number two, Mayor, since you've been basically run through the system, you've had it already, does that mean you're basically immune, and can you go out now, and do you still need to wear a mask and gloves, or and what are you suggesting to citizens?
So question number one is what we're seeing in terms of a response time on the test should be 2 to 4 days on average. So if you test it on Saturday, hopefully before Friday, you should have your results. That's what we're seeing as it normal. The second question is, I've been told by our medical experts that I'm immune to the strand of COVID-19 that I got. That doesn't mean that it can't mutate, which it may, and it doesn't mean that I can't potentially pass it along to a member of my family if I don't observe social distancing norms that would otherwise apply. So, for example, I am wearing gloves, I am wearing a mask, and I am, not just to try to be a good example, but also because when I come home, my wife demands that I, you know, that I basically decontaminate before I come in the house. And so, because you can carry it on your clothing and it's, you know, I mean, look, I believe that I got it from very, very minimal interaction with a delegation of Brazilians that came here to Miami. So, you know, if I could have gotten it through such a minimal interaction, then it could easily be passed, you know, through a variety of different ways. And so I'm just very blessed that my wife and my kids did not get it. So I think I got tested before I became symptomatic and before I could have transferred it.
All right. Well, Peter, thank you so much for the call. And I hope that test comes back negative for you. So hopefully you're feeling all right.
Same here.
All right. Thanks again for the call. Mayor, you know, before we go back to the phones, I wanted to come back to this again, this question of, this isn't just a conversation that's local. It's statewide, it's federal, it's when do we start thinking about reopening stuff? And people are struggling right now. Yes, there's the health, but there's also the economic health, and there are people just now getting their checks from the government, but there are people struggling to get their unemployment benefits. So, you know, the balance, how do you find that balance in these conversations, that balance of what needs to be done next?
You know, I'll tell you, I have, it's a tough balance without a doubt, but I'll tell you that I have, all my decisions have been guided on the medical advice in doing what is essential to protect the health and welfare of my residents first, and then letting the economic part come second. And the reason why is my philosophy and the philosophy of our commissioners has been the following. If we have a massive contagion of the virus, the spread of the virus, the economy is going to go into the ground anyways. And so what we've been trying to do is put in place measures that, you know, that will prevent the spread from happening. Now, if we open up too quickly, and let's say, for example, our school system is a good example, you've got 350,000 children just in the public school system alone. You've got, you know, hopefully there'll be like a month left of school. So the question is, do you take that chance with a month left and 350,000 children? If you have, you know, teachers coming back, the children, you know, anyone who's infected, anyone who's an asymptomatic carrier could, again, create another massive spread quickly. As we saw with this virus, it spread very, very quickly. I mean, all this has happened in essentially a month. I mean, we're right now on, you know, April 15th, and I was diagnosed positive on April 13th. So we are basically, and I was number two. So we're basically a month into this, and we've had, you know, over 500 deaths in Dade County,
right?
And a significant more. I'm sorry, over 100 deaths in Dade County, over 500 in the state, significantly more. You know, than in a very short period of time.
Right. And by the way, you said April 13th. You were tested positive March 13th, right?
I tested positive, sorry, March 13th.
Yeah. Okay. No, just
did I say May 13th?
Yeah, no, March. You said April. You said a couple of days ago.
Okay.
Again, talking with Miami Mayor Francis Suarez, and if you have a question, you can always find us on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Again, he was the second person in the city to test positive, one of the first mayors in the country, in the world, to test positive, and he had to be in self-isolation for 18 days. And take numerous tests before he could come back. Now he's coming back to a city, again, dealing with this, one of the hardest hit cities in the country. Again, 800-743-9576. Let's go to Marla in Key Biscayne. Marla, thanks for holding.
Yes, hello. I just have a question. You mentioned, Mayor Suarez, in-home testing. I've had terrible time trying to, you know, figure out where to go for testing. I have a husband, a daughter who's very asthmatic. So we just wanted to know, there's more information out there. Where do we find this information about getting actually getting your hands on an in-home testing? I didn't even know that was available.
Yes. And so essentially what we're doing is, if you live in the city of Miami, and this is where it gets a little confusing, you have to call 305-960-5050, and what happens is a member, they'll schedule you probably for tomorrow, and a member of the fire department will go to your home with, you know, the personal protective equipment, and it's usually one or two members, and they'll actually administer, take the sample right there. They'll get your documentation, and they'll process the sample, and you should have your results in 2 to 4 days. If you live in Miami-Dade County, if you don't live in the city, sometimes people don't know the difference.
Okay, yes. What would be Key Biscayne? Do you have any idea? I need to look that up.
Yes, so Key Biscayne is not in the city, obviously, but you would call 311. And I don't 100% know the Dade County process, but my guess is it's modeled after ours because we started ours so much earlier than they did. So I presume that they're just doing the same thing that we did. And so I would imagine you just call 311, and I presume that a few firefighters will come to your house like they've been doing in the city of Miami. And I'm glad that they're finally providing this in-home testing as well, because, as you mentioned, you know, so many people in our community are limited and can't drive or have other risk factors like what you're talking about, and really deserve to not have to leave the comfort of their home to get the comfort of being tested.
Okay, super, wonderful.
Marla,
okay.
Let us know how that goes, and we are always trying to put on our website, WLRN.org, you know, the different places and numbers that people can call. But let us know how that works out for you.
Will do. And I have to say, I so enjoy WLRN, and your program Sundial is amazing. Always tune in.
Well, Marla, thanks so much. And you and your family stay safe, and hopefully you can get that test done as quickly as possible.
Thank you. Thank you for the information. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Mayor, you know what, as I mentioned, you know, we're still a couple of weeks away from, you know, hitting that projected peak and so worried about that possible surge. I wonder what kind of conversations you've had with hospitals, healthcare workers in the area. I want to get a sense of their readiness. What are you hearing?
Well, what I'm hearing right now is that we're doing well. And when you say projected peak, we have to often be careful exactly what we mean by projected peak, because if again, there are three different levels of statistics, right? So the peak in terms of new cases, as far as I've seen on the dashboard, and again, there's some questions about the accuracy of the dashboard, but the projected peak was April 3rd. There was 1,300 cases in the state of Florida. There was about 530 in Miami-Dade County. Ever since April 3rd, and in Miami it was March 31st, ever since April 3rd, the number of new cases has actually been declining. So unless there is some sort of resurgence, we've hit the peak in terms of new cases. What has happened is, in terms of deaths, there is a lag, like I said, from the day you get infected, obviously, to the cycle of this virus. And so the deaths certainly are continuing to rise, and we've seen that some of the deadliest days, I think yesterday was probably the deadliest day in Florida. And so the death toll continues, unfortunately, to climb because people were infected, a week to 2 weeks ago. So, they're maybe talking about the peak of death.
Yeah, and mostly coming from state health officials, basically looking at and the CDC is the peak. We're expecting that surge when all of a sudden those cases might end up in the hospital. But I wondered what you've been hearing from healthcare workers. Are they ready for a possible surge?
What I've been hearing is, so far, assuming we don't have a New York style, a contagion, so far they feel good. They feel good about where they're at in terms of the percentage of beds that are available, in terms of, like I told you, the discharge to intake differential is extremely favorable for a while now. So what that indicates to me is that the social distancing and the stay-at-home measures are working. And so, I haven't seen the data. You know, I know people are talking about the peak was going to be April 21st, and now they're talking about May 15th. But again, I'm not certain as to what they're talking about in terms of, is it the peak number of hospitalizations, the peak number of cases, or the peak number of deaths? Because I can tell you the peak number of new cases, unless the data is wrong on the dashboard, and by the way, we're not 100% certain that it's right.
Okay.
Because I can tell you that Miami Herald just wrote a great article about all the private testing and the lag in private testing, and whether all that information is making its way onto the dashboard. So there's not 100% certainty that the dashboard is accurate, perfectly accurate, and there's obviously lags in information. But I do think that, in terms of new cases, we seem to be in a good place.
All right, I want to get one more call in here real quick. Mark from Alapata. Mark, thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call, Amir Suarez. What do I do about a small church that's here on 7th Avenue in Alapata that refuses to wear gloves or masks? There's 14 to 20 cars there 24 hours a day. And while it's noble that they hand out bags of food to the homeless people in the neighborhood, it's possible that if they're infected, they're infecting every homeless person they hand a bag of food to. I went online and I saw the pastor actually say that in a video that Jesus was better than hand sanitizers.
Yeah, I don't think that's a very good piece of advice. As much as we all are people of faith, many of us are people of faith and different kinds of faith. But I wouldn't substitute faith for hand sanitizer. What I would say is if you can call the non-emergency number for the Miami Police Department, if you Google non-emergency number for City of Miami, you can report what it is, and we can go out there and talk to them and tell them, look, you're not helping, and you're not promoting best practices, which could create major problems going forward. So we'd be happy to intervene.
Now, how does that interface with the governor's statement about churches being able to assemble?
And I was going to say that, you know, there is a potential preemption issue. I would, you know, but that doesn't prevent us from going out there as first responders and saying, look, you know, this is just not helpful. You know what I mean? And I think, you know, even if we had to provide them with some of that PPE, if the issue was that they didn't have it or couldn't get it or couldn't obtain it, you know, maybe we can help them facilitate it. We're getting donations constantly, every single day. Yesterday, I got someone who was donating 4,000 masks. So, I mean, we get donations every day. There's so many citizens in our community that are helping. So we can probably facilitate.
That would be helpful.
Mark, thank you so much for bringing that to our attention. And that is scary. You're right. The governor said church services can have an exemption, but you know, at the same time, you're handing out food to the homeless, and people could be asymptomatic. Mark, thanks so much for the call. Mayor, just to finish up here, that's interesting because, look, we're hearing different things from the White House, different things from Tallahassee, different things from our local leaders. You know, really, in a time like this, confusion isn't going to be helpful. So how do you go forward and try to communicate with Miamians about the best practices when we're hearing messages from all over that don't always mix?
Yeah. And I think that's been one of the biggest difficulties in this entire process has been the incoherence sometimes between government. I think we've gotten a lot of positive feedback for our the fact that we've been aggressive, that we've been forward thinking, and that we've done things that have, you know, prevented catastrophes like what we saw in New Orleans with Mardi Gras and in some of our beaches when our local officials refused to close the beaches. And we saw the spring breakers that got, unfortunately, national attention that was not positive. You know, I think, you know, every city is different. We're not New York. We're not Gainesville. We're not, you know, Tallahassee. Every city has its idiosyncrasies, and I think, and different densities and different climates. And I do think that, you know, it's very hard to implement a one-size-fits-all policy. And so I think, you know, we've handled it well at the local level. It's good to have the liberty and the freedom to be able to make these decisions locally to help our residents and not have our hands tied.
Yeah.
But it can definitely be confusing. And I sympathize with my residents who at times have seen a lot of incoherence between the cities and the county, for example.
Right. Before I let you go to it, because I didn't want to let this slip, you had mentioned it earlier, just briefly, you had donated some of your blood plasma for a patient who needed it, right?
I did. And I really feel that we should all feel obligated to do everything we can in this fight against COVID-19. And if you are able to beat it in your body, you know, I would urge you to reach out to the company I use with One Blood. I can tell you, I get messages on my Instagram every day from people that need plasma donations. They're being used for people who are convalescent, who are essentially intubated.
Yeah.
And it helps them because it helps their body fight COVID-19 using the antibodies in your own body. And so, you know, hopefully they can get off of the respirators and fully recover. So, you know, I urge everyone to do it if they can. And certainly we're going to be doing everything we can to highlight that and facilitate it if possible.
Mayor Francis Suarez, it's great to hear from you again. Great to hear that you're doing well. And, you know, this is going to go on for a little while. So we'll be talking again soon.
No doubt. Thank you, Louis.
And by the way, the thing that he was mentioning in giving your blood plasma, you know, we discussed this yesterday on the program with the folks from the Scripps Institute. And so if you want to learn more about that, you know, go back to that program. And, you know, it's something that we'll also, if you have questions, we'll help you find those answers. By the way, we were scheduled to speak with the director of Miami-Dade Public Transit, Alice Bravo, today. Unfortunately, she got pulled into a meeting with Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez last minute. However, she's rescheduled to join us tomorrow. And we want to know from you, if you ride public transit to get to work every day, what's that experience been like? When you get on the bus, you get on the train, are they crowded? And are people practicing that 6 feet? Are they wearing the protective masks, the gloves? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial or email us sundial@wlrnnews.org. Well, later in the program, we're going to learn how musicians are reaching fans during this coronavirus. You're listening to an online stream right now with Alejandro Sanz. But first, more than a month from the start of hurricane season, is the state ready to handle two crises at once? It's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. We are less than a month and a half away from hurricane season. Researchers are saying this year is likely to be more active than usual. The latest predictions say 16 named storms and a greater than 60% chance that a major storm hits the mainland U.S. We're joined now by WLRN environment reporter Jenny Stiletovich. Jenny, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Lewis.
I don't mean to add more bad news on top of what we're dealing with, but look, we have to deal with the fact that we're coming up on the season. We have to remember that many groups will list their forecast for the upcoming season, by the way, and that can change. So, Jenny, what is the forecast for this upcoming season? I kind of touched on it a little bit.
Yeah, so once again, they are forecasting an above average season. This would be the fifth in a row. And I will say this is coming out of Colorado State. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is not set to release their preseason forecast until the end of May. But Colorado State, which is a fairly reliable forecast, it's been around for a long time. It's traditionally one of the first to be issued, and they are calling for 16 named storms, 8 hurricanes, and 4 major hurricanes.
What are the challenges of you know, predicting, you know, just how busy a storm has been, and how accurate are they?
Well, I mean, the challenge is the further out you're predicting, the less accurate it is. So the closer the system or the closer to the season where you can see how conditions are setting up, the more good data you'll have to put into the model and make the prediction. So when NOAA issues its report, it'll come just days before the start of the season. Colorado State will also revise its forecast as it gets closer and has more information.
Do we know if right now the folks at the National Hurricane Center in Miami, how they're able to operate in these times? I don't know if all their staff are still working at the office or they're working remotely. How is it affecting them?
Yeah, so they are still working. I just spoke to them this morning, and they are so far things will proceed as usual. They're not expecting to make any changes in terms of when they issue advisories or how they do their forecasts. They have what they call a continuity of operations plan that they have around all the time, which means if for some reason the Miami office can't operate, then it shifts to another office. They have contingency plans in place in case those forecasters can't be operating out of that office. It's the same as if the hurricane actually were to hit Miami, you know, and that office becomes unoperational. So those are in place for, you know, coronavirus guidelines as well.
You reported that that last month was the driest on record, right?
Right.
How does that play a role in the upcoming hurricane season? Why should I be worried?
Well, it's not necessarily the drought. It's the temperatures. You know, we have had a really, really hot winter. We've been breaking temperature records. And that's what we need to keep an eye on because it heats up the ocean. Sea surface temperatures for the ocean are high right now. That's part of why Colorado State is forecasting a above average season, because the oceans are just really hot. So it's the temperature that's really what we want to keep an eye on.
All right. So, you know, it's a reminder to people we have to start preparing. But this is a strange time. And let's go over just the basic guidelines for preparing for a storm. I mean, it's just like the simple things we all know, right?
Right. I mean, you want to stock up, you want to have your storm kit ready in advance of the season. So I think it's a 3-day supply. I could be wrong. I'm sorry. Of water. You want to have, you know, batteries and flashlights and have important papers in a place where you can access them. So that stuff you should be ready for no matter what. I talked to Roman Gastizi, the county administrator from Monroe County, this morning, and he said regional managers are still talking about how they're going to prepare for the season and adhere to CDC guidelines for this coronavirus. So that's still kind of being hammered out, as far as I know.
Yeah. We've been talking with WLRN environment reporter Jenny Stiletovich. Jenny, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, staying on the issue of hurricanes, I mean, South Floridians know how to get ready, right? We know. Stock up. Get you know, what you need in food. Protect the windows with storm shutters. and have an evacuation plan if you need to. But how do you continue things like social distancing and getting access to limited supplies if a storm's coming? Is the state, is the federal government ready if we have a natural disaster? On top of all of this, I'm joined now by Abram Lustgarten, reporter for ProPublica, who looked into these questions and tried to find the answers. Let's see what he found. Abram, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Your piece, which, by the way, we'll share on our social media, WLRN Sundial, looked at the fact that, look, hurricane season's coming, flooding and rain in the Midwest is going to come too in the summer, and then, of course, fires out west, that basically Mother Nature and the issues with climate change don't stop because we're in the middle of a pandemic. You also looked at how the different agencies, state and federal, will deal with this, or if they can deal with this. Did you find any answers to that? Are we ready for that?
You know, surprisingly, answers were difficult to come by. And, the state agencies I was in touch with should get a partial pass because, this is a crisis period and everybody's kind of up to their necks answering questions. But the fact is, in both Florida and California, I didn't get specific answers to any of my questions about what changes state emergency operations were making to plan for the overlap of a natural disaster during the COVID pandemic.
Something you pointed out in your story that kind of sent some chills through me. You had talked to a former deputy science and technology advisor to the U.S. Secretary of State, and he told you, we cannot put our faith in the federal government in a time of crisis. Did your reporting back up that claim?
Puerto Rico was an example that I explored in my reporting as a place that's just sustained one disaster after another, Hurricanes Maria and Irma in 2017 and earthquake, now the COVID virus. It's a little bit unique politically from the rest of the United States, but that's where that sentiment comes from. And they have been waiting still to this day for the completion of promised FEMA aid, for dollars to come through for the full repair of electrical grid in some places that are just now coming back up online 2.5 years later. I spoke with an EPA administrator who used to run the EPA's response to Superstorm Sandy and also oversaw FEMA. FEMA's response to Puerto Rico. And she also discussed how FEMA has been overwhelmed in the years when it sees multiple disasters, like 2017 is a prime example. The agency struggles to be effective in the best of times, but what I heard consistently through my reporting is that it's quickly overwhelmed, it quickly runs out of funding. And if that is where people suffering from the impact of a storm are looking for help, it's not a reliable place to expect it to come from.
Let's take a look at Florida. As I mentioned, hurricane season is coming, and we're told the early predictions are busier than normal season. What did you learn about the state's plan for a storm, but also a storm in the middle of a pandemic?
So the state's Emergency Operations Center deferred, I sent them a list of about 12 specific questions, burrowing into the precise ways that their planning might change and whether they had been briefed or what kind of meetings or discussions they were having around the overlap of these kinds of events. They declined to answer any of those specific questions. They deferred me to the state's comprehensive emergency management plan, which is its general guidance for all hurricanes, for COVID, et cetera. They had made a couple of minor updates to that plan in February. It looked like, as the COVID crisis was unfolding, but the directives were not specific. So they pointed me to the idea that their plan is supposed to be flexible and adaptable and scalable to handle multiple crises. It is specific in its addressing of the importance of caring for people with medical needs in an evacuation, say, from a hurricane. So it says that those people maybe shouldn't be evacuated if there are medical concerns that are made worse by the evacuation. Maybe it's safer for them to stay in place. But there's nothing specifically related to a pandemic or the effect on a total population if, say, all of Florida's population is concerned about contracting the virus while adjusting to the threat of a major incoming storm or possible evacuation. And when I went back to the department to say, does this plan mean, the suggestion mean that you wouldn't evacuate during a major hurricane this year? They didn't respond to that question either. So it's really hard to know if they have plans in the works that they're not making public or if they're really behind the ball in considering these potential, you know, outcomes.
That is confusing and frightening at the same time, because when a storm comes, we know there are certain areas that must evacuate because they might not be able to handle whatever that storm is that's coming. And now we're saying we don't know if they should evacuate. We should just leave them in place. That's basically what you heard.
Well, that's basically what the document implies. I mean, my sense from the broader reporting, when I talk to climate experts and disaster experts about what happens when you have cascading disasters, you know, it's that each one amplifies, you know, the one before it, and the net damage, the net effect is greater than it might have been from any one catastrophe in itself. And so, you know, if you kind of assume that evacuations or response to a major hurricane would proceed as they have in the past, then what these experts say is that you can expect that there's going to be greater health risk and greater exposure to the virus. And so probably, you know, people will evacuate, or they will move in with family, or they will be sheltered in places where they need to be, because you know their homes may be destroyed, and they'll have an enhanced and prolonged exposure to the virus, and probably the spread of that virus will grow as a result.
And of course, these are questions we're going to be digging into as well as we get closer to the hurricane season. We're talking with Abram Lustgarten, again, reporter for ProPublica, whose latest piece is called "Climate Change Won't Stop for the Coronavirus Pandemic." You can find a link to the story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Abram, there's a potential economic toll here for a hurricane that can have in a community, particularly when we explore the skyrocketing cost of insurance. Based on your conversations with risk managers, how much worse could that cost be in the middle of a pandemic on top of a hurricane?
Yeah, so this is one of the most interesting things that I came across. Risk Management Solutions is, you know, one of the leading analyzers of this sort of risk and putting a dollar figure on it. And they had just completed this, and they their models estimate that a hurricane in Florida this season might cost 20% more in damages than it might otherwise cost. What, you know, because of the overlap of the pandemic, and that's a cost in terms of building replacement, damage to infrastructure, damage to roads. Doesn't really calculate or include the social costs as well, but gives a sense of how many more billions of dollars this season could exact from the public.
And one thing you pointed out too is the fact that, look, let's say for example a roof is damaged, you need to get that replaced quickly, because more rain could damage the walls, could damage the structure. And if you've got workers who are not able to work, or you know, you can't get crews out there because they can't be close together, they have to social distance, that could mean more damage to the houses. Thus, the costs go up.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, this really gets at the subtle, you know, ripple effects of cascading disasters, where the insurance industry looks to speed and supply chains as, you know, one of the most critical things affecting, you know, their ability to keep people safe and their ability to bring, you know, a community back to normal cost effectively. And if they can't get building supplies and they can't get workers to come in and work, both of those things run slower, and the damage is increased and the costs go up.
You know, this pandemic obviously has overshadowed everything. I mean, it's even put the election aside for now. But what have you heard from people about your piece, what they've said about the piece? But what are they saying? What are people thinking about climate change during a pandemic?
Well, it's a real mixed bag. I mean, I think for obvious reasons, you know, the emergency that's closest in front of our face is the one that's, you know, occupying most people's attention. So, you know, to a large degree, discussion consideration of climate change has been backburnered, I think, at least temporarily, you know, to overgeneralize, you know, amongst many people. Of course, the kind of people that I was talking to, you know, disaster experts are considering exactly the effects that I wrote about, which is, you know, how these cascading crises might overlap. And so they're still very much focused on it. There's another, you know, large body of thinking, you know, around the environmental, short-term environmental benefits of the kind of shelter in place that many of us are experiencing. The reduction in emissions, the reduction in pollution, the reduction in energy use from transportation and so forth. You know, so that might be a sort of a short-term silver lining. But I haven't seen the conversation really advance too far past that yet. I expect it's going to, you know, rebound in the next couple of weeks.
Abram Lustgarten again with ProPublica's latest piece called "Climate Change Won't Stop for the Coronavirus Pandemic." You can find a link on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Abram, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, still to come, you can't go to a live concert right now, but can they come to you? We explore South Florida's live streaming music scene coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, you know what? A week ago, I was supposed to go to a concert. I was going to see Pearl Jam, and it got canceled. So I've got to adapt. And the music industry has been forced to adapt to this new landscape of the pandemic. Artists depend a lot on those live concerts to make their money, since revenues for streaming music and album purchases are going down. So the stay-at-home orders, they're hitting folks hard. Musicians have long been streaming their concerts online, but now more and more are using the internet to connect with their fans and showcase new songs and even make some dough. WLRN producer Chris Remington recently looked at South Florida musicians going this route and what their experience has been thus far.
Alejandro Sanz and Juanes are both used to playing sold-out concerts to thousands of fans from across the globe. Then, around mid-March, the musicians learned their concert in Colombia was canceled to prevent the spread of COVID-19. The next day, they reached out to their friend and producer, Julio Reyes Copello.
We've been talking about this for a long time. I actually have all the structure in the studio to do it.
Copello is the head of the new Abbey Road Institute in downtown Miami. He's produced albums for both Sanz and Juanes in the past. And he says once he got them in the studio for a live stream, it was pretty easy.
We were basically having a jam. We didn't have time to rehearse. And that, I think, made it so special because we were actually creating new versions from scratch.
That live stream lasted a little more than an hour. It was posted on YouTube and it now has over 2 million views, plus comments in English and Spanish coming from all over the globe. They were mostly about the music and showing their support, with one key exception.
Well, actually, in the middle of the concert, we got the sad news that the president of Universal Music got the virus.
The musicians took a moment to express their concern and then let the music speak for itself.
You can actually create a parallel universe where you are free of your problems for 4 minutes or 5 minutes that a song lasts.
What I've heard from a lot of people that did get to watch it was that they felt like they had been isolated without a lot of interaction with people. Nobody
likes to be told what to do. Nobody likes Christina Amador Garcia goes by Kusi. She's from the Miami electronic duo Afro Beta.
And all of a sudden, they were all watching this thing together as if they were at a show. Just writing back to each other in the chat was really fun for them.
The group live-streamed a concert from the North Beach Bandshell in late March. Kusi improvised, reflecting the spirit of the moment and the lack of toilet paper.
I've been a fan for 11 years.
Craig Southern vividly remembers his first Afro Beta concert.
The way that you're feeling at that time, it kind of imprints those memories. I just fell in love from first listen.
He listens to everything the band puts out, and he thought the live stream did lack some of the magic of a regular concert.
There's nothing like being there in the moment, in three-dimensional reality, and experiencing it. The next best thing would be the live stream.
And for Afro Beta, live concerts are essential for survival.
The most of the money comes from playing live.
Yeah, there's very little money that comes in from streams and that kind of stuff.
But 90% of our income comes from the
99.9.
Yeah. Yeah.
The first voice you heard there, Tony Smurfio Lorenzio, the other half of Afro Beta. The band doesn't plan on charging for live streams yet, but some fans took it upon themselves to help through Venmo.
We did get some tips. Some people wrote to each other on the posts. We got about $175.
They both say the live stream concerts are less about making money and more about growing their support. And they've ended up with some new, unexpected fans.
One of our songs has a lyric that says, "I'll just keep dancing on my own." we've had, for some weird reason, people sending us videos of them, like, singing the song.
Not people, actually, kids.
Kids, okay. we're really big in the four-year-old demographic right now.
As this pandemic continues, a lot of us are going to be dancing on our own. I'm Chris Remington in Miami.
And you can read the full story and see other at-home streaming options by going to WLRN.org/coronavirus. And by the way, we'd love to hear from you. How are you following your favorite artists right now? Or maybe you're a local artist. How are you doing it with live streaming? Are you making it work? Find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Wednesday, April 15th. Coming up tomorrow, Miami-Dade Director of Public Transit, Alice Bravo, will join us. And we want to hear from you if you are taking public transit now. What are your experiences like? What are your concerns? Email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Always on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Plus, also, people of color have been disproportionately impacted by the coronavirus. We're going to explore how prejudice within our healthcare system is having a direct impact on them. All of that tomorrow on the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Stay safe. Keep that 6 feet distance. We'll talk to you tomorrow.